What next for Mexico City today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. In earthquake-prone Mexico City, it wasn't just last week's quake that damaged buildings.
Several earthquakes have already hurt this building. This was probably made around 1950s, I guess.
And our own correspondent in Mexico City shares some of the lessons she's learned since the ground started shaking.
There was an earthquake this weekend, and I ran out with my baby barefoot because I didn't have shoes at the door. That's something you need to have.
Plus, what gift do you get the Facebook billionaire who's got it all?
They said, do not get Mark Zuckerberg a cowboy hat. So I got him a hoodie.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Glad to have you here on this Tuesday. We're staying across the situation in Puerto Rico following Hurricane Maria. We hear from people on the island that things are dire. Some even see a humanitarian disaster in the making. And we're also hearing complaints that Washington isn't moving fast enough to get aid to the island. At a press conference today, Trump dismissed those complaints.
We have had tremendous reviews from government officials, as we have in Texas and Louisiana, and as we have in Florida, as you know, from Governor Scott and Greg Abbott, great governors. And this morning, the governor made incredible statements about how well we're doing. We understand it's a disaster. It's a disaster that just happened. The grid was in bad shape before the storm. And Puerto Rico didn't get hit by one hurricane. Got hit by two hurricanes.
Trump then pressed his case.
We right now have our top people from FEMA, and they have been there. We are unloading on an hourly basis massive loads of water and food and supplies for Puerto Rico. And this isn't like Florida, where we can go right up the spine, or like Texas, where we go right down the middle and we distribute. This is, you know, a thing called the Atlantic Ocean. This is tough stuff.
We'll have more coverage from Puerto Rico in the days ahead. Today, though, we turn to Mexico City, which is also trying to recover from that massive earthquake a week ago. The death toll from the quake in Mexico City and outside the Mexican capital has now surpassed 300 people. What happened a week ago changed the lives of many people in Mexico City and surrounding areas. That includes The World's Monica Campbell, who is based in Mexico City. She was here in our Boston newsroom a week ago when the quake hit and was able to rejoin her husband and baby over the weekend. I know your neighborhood, La Condesa, got hit particularly hard. You and your family and neighbors can't get back in your building. What is the mood like? How are people getting on?
Well, I went back yesterday and, you know, parts of the city are going back to normal. Where I live, it's one of the most hardest hit areas, and you still have rescue efforts going on. You also have this huge outpouring of civilian volunteers helping victims and their families. You have teams of doctors and nurses roaming around taking the blood pressure of residents in the area, people giving massages to people.
Just to deal with stress and anxiety.
Yeah. Like people will just walk up to some, you know, these kind of crews of nurses and doctors. It's like, can you take my blood pressure?
Wow.
You know, I'm feeling really stressed out. I've lost my home. There's stands set up for people who need counseling. And then I went to my building, and when I walked up, all the neighbors were outside on the sidewalk figuring out what's next. Like, what's going to happen to the building? Is it salvageable? Will it be demolished? And different engineers have come by and done tours of the building, but really nothing has been officially sort of stated or given to the owners of the apartment building. So there's a lot of confusion, and people are leaving the building for good. I mean, for example, in my case, we're leaving. Mm. We're renters. And one family, they didn't have time to wait around. The father, Rico, worked in the building. He was like the maintenance guy. And his wife, Gabby, was a housekeeper in the building and in the neighborhood. And they're moving back to a completely different part of the country. And she told me what kind of worried her most right now.
Pues el trabajo. Nos preocupa de que,
and Gabby was saying what worries her most right now is work. They can't go a week without work. They live week to week, and they're worried that they're not going to have the money to buy like the school supplies for the little girl who's in elementary school and things like that. So huge concern for that family in particular.
And the building, Monica, next to yours, do I have this right? It was severely damaged in the 85 quake, but was still standing and never torn down?
It was never torn down, and I didn't know that it had been so severely damaged in the 85 quake. I thought it was just this like old building. I wasn't even sure if people lived in it or not. All I knew about this building next to ours was that there's an ice cream shop on the bottom floor. Mm. And turns out that it actually had been scheduled to be demolished after 1985. Who knows what happened, but it was still standing. And now they say, okay, we're going to tear this building down. And I talked to the owner of the ice cream shop. His name is Carlos Cruz Licona. And I talked to him about the history of the building.
The history of this building, this was probably made around 1950s, I guess. Several earthquakes have already hurt this building, although they said it was safe, and actually the government permitted people to live here. They only made very small jobs to repair it, but not rebuild it.
And when you rented it, did you ask about that?
Yes. I had to ask permission to the government.
And what did they say? They said, oh.
It was okay.
What would you tell people who might come and want to live here or rent a store here again?
No. Definitely no. Not in this area.
So Carlos Cruz Licona, pretty clear that his building is not safe. But this is a determination that's still being made all over the city. Like, how safe is my building? How are people who are not trained in structural engineering going about that?
Right. So when I was at my building, actually, this, they're calling brigades, this brigade of civil engineers came by. And it was this woman, she's civil engineer, and somebody apparently in our building had called to have one of these brigades stop by your building if you're worried about it. And so she was there and she took a look at our building. She determined that our building likely needs to be demolished. And she's going around and really helping people answer that question, like, can we go back in the building? Is it safe? And she holds a lot of credibility because she's independent. And there's this idea that, like, she's not getting paid. She's going in there and she's giving people kind of the full read on what she's seeing. And I went with her to a couple of different buildings in the neighborhood.
Yeah, tell us what you saw.
Well, we went into some buildings and they were fine and some weren't so great. And what was interesting, we went into this one building and it was this old building, about three stories. From the outside, the damage seemed pretty light, just some facade had come off. And we walked in and there was all this construction going on, and that really kind of tipped off this engineer, and her name's Araceli Arenas. And it was really clear to her that this place was being remodeled for new tenants. You know, this is a really desirable neighborhood, so, you know, it makes sense. You're going to remodel these apartments and really charge, you know, high rent to people wanting to live in this neighborhood. So there's an architect in the building, and he got really nervous. And she's, you know, looking, and she's looking at this remodeling. It looks a little shabby. She has to go to the top floor. And we get to the top of the building, and there's all these hundreds of bags of concrete. And all these guys are on the roof, covered in dust, working away really furiously. And it was really clear that the owner of this building was building new apartments on top of this old building. And that's when things got pretty heated.
No hay ningún problema que lo estés haciendo, o sea, no pasa nada.
Entiéndeme una cosa.
No te preocupes.
En este nivel ya estaba construido todo.
So she asked the architect, you know, for his license, a building permit. Where was all the paperwork to do this? Where was all the paperwork to build these new apartments on top of this kind of old building? And she could just see from her trained eye, this was not construction that was solid. And the architect got really nervous. He asked her to leave. He actually tried to grab her phone away from her when she wanted to call in to report it. And it was to the engineers, but it was really clear. This guy did not want anybody around looking at what he was doing. And for her, it was really disturbing because she saw exactly the type of thing that makes this already earthquake-prone neighborhood more dangerous.
Right.
This time, she called it clandestine construction, the putting new apartments, you're going to rent them out for a lot of money, and you're skirting the codes, it's shabby work. And I asked her, I said, you know, do you see this a lot? And she goes, absolutely. And it was kind of remarkable to see this sort of up front.
That's the world's Monica Campbell in Mexico City. Monica, thank you very much, and stay safe.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Now, I mentioned a moment ago the name of Monica's Mexico City neighborhood, La Condesa. Many journalists happen to live in La Condesa, so we're hearing lots of compelling post-earthquake stories from there. This next one is especially heart-wrenching. It's about a well-known photojournalist who suffered a terrible loss in this quake. Here's reporter Emily Green in Mexico City.
Wesley Boxey grew up in New York City in the 70s. In fact, his first pictures were of his skateboard buddies. But Boxey was a teenage troublemaker. And so, in his late teens, his parents sent him to Peru. That's where his mom was from originally. The hope was that a little time with family outside of New York might improve his behavior. Boxy took his camera with him. And it's there that he got his start as a photojournalist. He eventually got a job with Reuters. Then, in 1985, the Mexico earthquake hit, and Boxy got sent to Mexico City. He talks about that experience in an old interview conducted in Spanish.
I consider it my first big break, covering that earthquake in Mexico in 1985.
Estimates put the death toll from that quake at around 10,000.
And I saw things I never imagined I would see. The experience was so impactful that even today, I remember it as if it were yesterday.
There was a video journalist also covering the 85 earthquake who knew Boxy well, Miguel Rial.
I remember him, see him work in the rubbles, you know, in the buildings. He was very patient. When he wants something, he was waiting for hours and hours just to get the right pictures.
Rial says Boxy covered more than a dozen wars as a photojournalist, from Nicaragua and El Salvador in the 1980s to the first Persian Gulf War and the siege of Sarajevo in the early 90s.
He was a lone wolf correspondent. He always looked in his own way to the story. He was covered the story was nobody covered.
He covered the story nobody else has covered.
Yeah. I don't remember with Wesley to be like scared and say, don't go. Don't cross that line.
But Rial says his friend and colleague became disenchanted with war coverage. Boxy didn't like the fact that journalists increasingly had to be embedded with military units. So Boxy retired from full-time photojournalism. He settled in Mexico City and started making and selling bags for carrying photography equipment. His early styles were based on bags the Sandinistas, a Nicaraguan political and military group, used to carry bullets for their guns. Leslie Mazak is a photo editor at the Associated Press in Mexico City. She bought some of Boxy's equipment, and she and her husband became friends with Boxy and his wife, Elizabeth Esquera Rosas.
The last time we were with them was about a month ago in their apartment. They had us over for breakfast, and Wesley made us waffles with, like, cream, all kinds of cream and coffee. And Amara, their daughter, was there. And just had, you know, a lovely, normal Sunday breakfast, you know, in Mexico City.
And then, 32 years to the day after the 85 earthquake, another one struck. Mazak says Boxy and his wife were in their penthouse seventh-floor apartment in the neighborhood of Condesa.
You know, I'm trying to work and check on friends at the same time. And around, when I got off work at 7, you know, and I'm going through my mind of all the people I still need to check on, Wesley and Elizabeth are not answering their phones. And I start freaking out. And so I walk over to their apartment, and I see it's collapsed.
Boxy was found seriously injured on the street. Elizabeth was missing for a day before her body was found. Their 5-year-old daughter, Amara, was at school and survived. Four days after the quake, mourners sang as Elizabeth was buried. Boxy was still in the hospital. Video journalist Miguel Rial says it's ironic that Boxy covered so many wars, only to have an earthquake devastate his life.
In the war zones, you control your safety. You know how to move. You can control the situations. You have limits. With the nature, you cannot control anything. We don't know how to deal with nature. And I think nature is something like you have to respect.
Wesley Boxy remains in intensive care. Friends and family say he knows his wife has died. They are hopeful he will survive. For The World, Emily Green, Mexico City.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. It is Tuesday, and that means it's time for 50 States. That is our cross-country reporting project looking at America's place in a shrinking world. We're visiting state number 9 today, Oregon. Here's The World's Rupa Shenoy.
The people of Prineville live deep in a valley, surrounded by dense forest.
It's remote now, but in the 1800s, Prineville was the first place in central Oregon where white settlers drove out Native Americans to start a city.
It's a magical, magical place to grow up.
Steve Forrester's grandparents got here in 1902. When he was growing up in the 1970s, Prineville was idyllic.
My dad worked in the sawmill industry as an electrician. My mom didn't work. We all learned how to hunt and shoot a gun, and we all learned how to drive in the forest before we were 16, and everybody had a job and everybody did well.
Prineville was the largest producer of ponderosa pine in the world. But when the federal government restricted logging and increased protections for animals like the spotted owl, the city's milling industry was decimated. As an adult, though, Forrester still took a job with one of the few remaining mills just because he wanted to live in Prineville. Eric Klon was driven by the same devotion. He's the seventh generation of his family to live here. And out of college, he also took a job in Prineville that he knew wouldn't last.
There was always a little voice in the back of my head saying, you know, what are you doing? You want to be here, but you're in a dying industry.
A few years later, the nationwide housing bubble burst and demand dropped for housing parts made by the last mills. Lots of people lost jobs and left. Both Forrester and Klon felt lucky to land jobs at the city. Forrester as city manager and Klon as city engineer. Their chance to save Prineville came in 2009, arriving in the form of a mysterious email from a company called Vitesse.
And for the longest time, we had no idea what Vitesse meant.
All Klon knew is that Prineville's natural resources made it perfect for a new industry, the information industry, created to save the massive amounts of information people post on the web. Vitesse wanted to build a big warehouse and fill it with rows and rows of servers, servers that tend to get hot. Central Oregon's cold nights could cool them naturally. Klon remembers the first in-person meeting with Vitesse and how it felt like Prineville's last chance.
Right before I walked into our conference room to meet with their nine lawyers that had flown up to Prineville, I got an email and our unemployment rate had peaked at 23%. And then I walked into that room and I just kept thinking, we better not screw this up.
Klon and Forrester decided to outperform the other cities Vitesse was considering. They showed the company their small town could move at big city speed by responding to Vitesse's questions day and night. Their strategy worked, and in 2010, Prineville finally learned who Vitesse actually is. Mayor Betty Ropey was at the new data center's groundbreaking.
They had the big finger with the thumb up, Facebook sign, and we all pushed the button and it lit up, etc. And that's how they announced it was Facebook. That was the big announcement, it was Facebook.
It was Facebook's first data center of its own. Mark Zuckerberg was there, and Ropey had planned to give him a cowboy hat to show the city's pride in its cowboy culture.
Cowboy hats are not cheap. You know, so anyway, they said, do not get Mark Zuckerberg a cowboy hat. He does not want a cowboy hat. So I got him a hoodie. He wears hoodies all the time. So when I go to present his gift to him, I gave him a kiss on the cheek, and oh my God, he just blushed like... He just looked like he wanted to have the floor open up and swallow him.
7 years later, Facebook has two additional data centers in Prineville and six more across the world. Apple's moved into Prineville, too. It's built three data centers here. All of them sit high above Prineville's valley in huge, long, flat buildings painted pale blue and gray so they blend in with the sky. About 500 employees work in the centers, most of them from Prineville. And security's tight, so few other people ever see inside.
I can't get my congressman into Apple. Seriously.
Despite their low profile, the data centers have had a profound impact on the town. Mayor Ropey drove me around to show me all the progress.
This road is closed because we are building a new city jail. Our new, brand new elementary school is right up here on the hill. These are all new homes. You can see there's another one being built. This is our high school. We just paid that off.
Ropey says the mills taught Prineville a lesson, to not rely on just one industry. So they're putting in things that appeal to lots of employers. Good roads, modern wastewater treatment, a state college outpost. Facebook's data center manager in Prineville, Todd Flack, says that's what's important about what's happened here. The city's become stable, resilient, and modern.
Really, the story in Prineville is about the real close partnership that we've maintained with the city, county, and state representatives that were very key to try to help diversify their economy and retain jobs and bring new skill sets to their town.
But now that the city's successful, officials have a lot more to think about. Like, how do you slow success down?
We can keep the small town feel. I'm sure of it. We don't want to be a big city.
The cost of housing's up, so city officials know they have to build more affordable housing. And Mayor Ropey's own granddaughter with a college degree can't find a living wage job. So the city has to keep bringing in new employers. All Prineville manager Steve Forrester can do is calibrate the development carefully. He worries about Prineville changing too much, too.
We are small town people, and we live the Western lifestyle. The quiet and the peacefulness of Central Oregon is a wonderful, beautiful thing. And to be able to make a living here to afford to be able to do those things is tremendous.
Forrester sees nearby towns that don't adapt die. And he knows he has to risk changing Prineville in order to save it. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Prineville, Oregon.
You can find all of our 50 states coverage on our website. That is pri.org/50states. Here's a quick one before the break. I couldn't resist because it actually involves one of our BBC colleagues.
Hello and welcome to Newsday on the BBC. I'm Rico Hizon in Singapore. And in our Power of Asia season, we meet some of the 1 million Indonesian women employed as domestic workers in Saudi Arabia.
Rico Hizon is a familiar face on BBC TV programs out of Asia. He's originally from the Philippines, and most of the time on air, he's a serious guy. Like after the election of the controversial Rodrigo Duterte as president of the Philippines, the intrepid Hizon went to Duterte's hometown ready to ask some tough questions.
We were assured of an interview and told where to track him down. But he keeps curious hours and holds court in unconventional places.
Hizon never managed to track down Duterte, but recently he did manage to secure another big-name interview.
For the first time, Sesame Street's Elmo is in Singapore, and Elmo joins me right here in the studio. Hi, Elmo! Can I hug you, Elmo? Oh, my gosh! This is a moment, Elmo, that I've been waiting for since I was a kid.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow. Elmo's mission in Asia, by the way, to spread kindness.
You know, Elmo, that is what we need in the world today. We need kindness. We need laughter. We need happiness. just listen to the news that we delivered today. There's not a whole lot of it.
Well, Elmo's here telling everybody that it's very important to be kind to one another.
Yeah, you could tell Rico Hizon was obviously pumped for this interview. What you didn't see is that he was wearing red socks and a red tie in honor of Elmo, and he practiced his impression of the count.
One Elmo. Ha, 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 ha.
Wow, that's really good.
In return, Elmo sang a special version of his theme song for Hizon.
La, 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 Rico song.
Oh!
La, 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 Rico song. That's Rico song.
Oh, wonderful.
My colleague Rico Hizon at the BBC raising the bar for all broadcasters and showing us how to have fun.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple. Jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Donald Trump loves Twitter, especially when it comes to talking tough on North Korea. But that's got diplomats and techies alike worried.
Donald Trump has kind of changed the way people communicate on Twitter and the way people conduct diplomacy on Twitter.
Trump's effect on Twitter diplomacy, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Just when it seems like the rhetoric between Pyongyang and Washington couldn't get more belligerent, it does. Take the past 24 hours. North Korea's foreign minister declared his country was ready to defend itself by shooting down U.S. planes, even those outside its borders. Then he accused President Trump of declaring war on the country. The U.S. dismissed the accusation as absurd, and when asked about North Korea today at a press conference, Trump said,
North Korea is a situation that should have been handled 25 years ago, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, and 5 years ago, and it could have been handled much more easily. You had various administrations, many administrations, which left me a mess. But I'll fix the mess. So we'll see what happens with North Korea.
The president once again said that the military option was on the table and that it would be devastating for North Korea. Where could all this lead? Well, both sides have much to gain from avoiding confrontation. Still, the unthinkable could happen.
There can always be a miscalculation.
That's Jeffrey Bader. He's been in the Oval Office during discussions about how to rein in North Korea. Bader served as a senior advisor to President Barack Obama on Asia.
We looked for all manner of ways to deter North Korea and to try to change their behavior without great success, I must say. But I've never heard any military leaders or senior officials of the United States suggest that getting into a name-calling contest in which we escalate threats on both sides was likely to lead to any positive results.
All right. We all hate thinking about it, but what if, let's say, President Trump decided to take action and launch a nuclear attack on his own authority? Could his chief of staff or his national security team step in if they disagreed?
They have no constitutional or legal authority to do so. Under President Nixon in his final days in office, when his senior colleagues thought he had been drinking too much and was perhaps getting emotional in his approach to the job, it's reported that Secretary of Defense Schlesinger and Chief of Staff Al Haig passed word to the National Military Command Center that if they received an order from President Nixon that they considered to be inappropriate, which was a reference to possible use of nuclear weapons, they should be in touch with them before acting upon it. But that was informal. I recently wrote an op-ed suggesting that we should have a change in the law so that key officials, particularly the congressional leadership, should have to sign off on a preemptive or preventive nuclear strike by the president. We haven't had a declaration of war by the Congress since 1941, despite the language of Article 1 of the Constitution. And I think it's time for Congress to claw back some of its authority, at least in the nuclear realm, with this unstable president.
Can you assess for us a degree of concern about all of this at the highest levels of the foreign policy establishment?
There's great concern over the president's habit of tweeting insults, because not that much is known about Kim Jong-un, what makes him tick. And there is real concern that there may be a miscalculation, there may be an overreaction, and that this could spin out of control.
Is it possible that Trump's tough talk is in fact strategic and part of an effort a team in the White House has devised to intimidate North Korea and keep Kim Jong-un guessing?
I mean, I've heard the argument going back to Nixon about the madman theory. Nixon was not a madman, but he liked to present himself as unpredictable. I think what Trump is conveying more than unpredictability is that he doesn't really have a grasp on the situation, and there's an awful lot of bluffing.
Does it give you any hope that the Chinese are being as sober as they can, it seems, about this? I mean, where do you find the hope?
I think that the major national security figures around President Trump are sensible on these issues. I think in particular Secretary of Defense Mattis fully understands the dangers of an escalation to a military conflict and the staggering numbers of casualties that would ensue. Besides which, would South Korea continue to be an ally if we engaged in a preemptive strike against North Korea and tens of thousands of South Koreans as well as their fellow North Koreans died? I think that would break the alliance, frankly. But I think Mattis fully understands that. I think that Secretary Tillerson is aligned with Secretary Mattis on this, and National Security Advisor General McMaster, I think, also generally understands that he's been somewhat hard to read in his public comments.
I have to ask this, Jeffrey. Do Mattis or Tillerson have what it takes to take the nuclear football out of Trump's hands if that day comes?
I don't know what would happen in that case. I find it hard to believe that General Mattis would assent to a preemptive nuclear strike under any foreseeable circumstances. That would give him limited options. He would presumably have to resign if he objected, and the president presumably could proceed with another official. So I don't think that the current legal arrangements are sufficient. That's why I think we need a change in the law.
Well, we don't want to think about it, but I'm glad we spoke about it. Jeffrey Bader served as senior advisor to President Barack Obama on Asia from 2009 to 2011. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us.
Real pleasure to talk to you, Marco.
Like many of the flare-ups we've seen so far during the Trump administration, this latest one with North Korea began with a tweet. Over the weekend, President Trump posted the following: just heard Foreign Minister of North Korea speak at UN. If he echoes thoughts of Little Rocket Man, they won't be around much longer! Exclamation point. North Korea interpreted that last part of the tweet as a declaration of war. Many users have since called on the platform to take the post down, claiming it violates Twitter's guidelines against making violent threats. Twitter responded to the controversy yesterday. The company did not say whether the president's tweet broke the rules, but they did say the tweet in question isn't going anywhere because of its newsworthiness. For more on this, we reached out to Matthias Lufkens. He is a founder of Twiplomacy.
We've been basically looking at how world leaders, governments, and foreign ministers use Twitter and other social networks. And Donald Trump has kind of changed the way people communicate on Twitter and the way people conduct diplomacy on Twitter.
I mean, he is using his private account at Real Donald Trump. It's the one he used when he was Citizen Donald Trump, not President Donald Trump. Does that make a difference? I mean, he has the at POTUS account, which he can tweet on and which is archived and on the government record.
This is really interesting because when Barack Obama set up the Twitter account of the White House, he then set up his own personal Twitter account, the POTUS account. But his campaign account, Barack Obama, was never an official administration account. And there was a clear separation. With Donald Trump, this is different. So he continues to use his campaign account personally rather than the official POTUS account. So he's basically brought in a new way to use social media.
Right. And a lot of people would argue that everything that the president posts at Real Donald Trump is newsworthy. And in the past, he's posted content that users say incites violence. I mean, we've got this edited video that he retweeted earlier this month where he appeared to be hitting a golf ball and it hits his former campaign rival Hillary Clinton on the head. Do you think Twitter is taking the right approach here, or should they have additional standards beyond newsworthiness?
Well, I think, you know, the tweets of the U.S. president at Real Donald Trump are newsworthy and of public interest. So, you know, it is, I think Twitter made the right decision to leave these tweets, even though you can argue they can contravene against the terms of and conditions of Twitter. So it's really difficult for Twitter. It's, you know, a very thin line to walk, you know, what is newsworthy and what is not. So we'll see how it will pan out.
How much is Twitter having to deal with these sorts of scenarios in other parts of the world? I mean, you study at Twiplomacy how world leaders use social media.
Well, we haven't really seen these exchanges on Twitter. There was a time when the former president of Colombia called the then president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, an assassin. Mm. But, you know, with the very, very few rants that we've seen over the past years, you know, it has been very, very civil, I would say, the discourse between world leaders. And, you know, the new way of using Twitter personally by the U.S. president is something unusual, I should say.
What if down the line Twitter does go a different route and takes down tweets by Donald Trump and other political leaders? What kind of impact do you think that could have on political dialogue, on diplomacy?
I think, you know, taking down a tweet by a world leader, be it Donald Trump or any other world leader, I think would have the opposite effect. I mean, we would, you know, you would find that tweet, you know, everywhere else. You would find, you know, screenshots on Instagram, on Flickr, you name it. It would actually give the tweet much more power. So I think, you know, it's counterproductive.
Finally, Matthias, who's your favorite politician or government official on Twitter, like either for honesty, wisdom, or entertainment?
Oh, that's a good question. I have my favorite is Danish Foreign Minister Anders Samuelsen, because, you know, he uses Twitter, Instagram and Facebook personally himself. So I do like him. And maybe I'm biased. I'm German. But I think mm-hmm. the German Foreign Ministry is doing actually a really, really good job showing sometimes a human side. I mean, there was this brilliant tweet after the Brexit vote in Britain, where at the end of the day, the social media manager on the official page tweeted and posted on Facebook saying, well, we're now going to an Irish pub and get, you know, utterly sloshed.
Well, thank you very much for the recommendations. That's Matthias Lufkens, the founder of Twiplomacy, speaking with us from Geneva. Thank you very much, Matthias.
Thank you very much for having me.
Undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children were granted special protections from deportation during the Obama years. It's a program, as you may know, called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. But recently, President Trump says his administration will phase it out. That leaves many DACA recipients in limbo. Some may be able to extend their protected status for up to 2 years, if they want to, that is. From Provo, Utah, Andrea Smartin has a story of one DACA recipient who is weighing her options.
When Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that DACA would be rescinded, Laura Lopez felt it in a physical way. The temporary relief that DACA offered was gone.
So I've just been really disappointed. I've been really sad. And I have been really stressed. It's been showing up in my body.
I talk with Lopez in her car so she can speak freely without her kids hearing. Lopez says she's been experiencing stomach pain and difficulty sleeping ever since Donald Trump was elected president. It's a familiar feeling from childhood when her father first left their home in Mexico and then when she followed him to the U.S. as a teenager.
I do have an anxiety. I was diagnosed in the spectrum of PTSD. I was told it was because of, you know, the experiences that I had ever since we arrived here. But yeah, the stomach pain has been stronger lately.
Lopez says she first applied for DACA because she's lost jobs without the required paperwork. And when the program was announced in 2012, she had a two-week-old baby. He was sleeping in her arms as she watched President Obama explain that DACA would allow those who qualified to work, go to school, and be protected from deportation.
Seeking a type of protection through DACA was a relief because you say, okay, I have that.
But Lopez's protected status is set to run out soon. For those like her whose DACA status expires between September 5th and March 5th, there's an option to renew the application and get an extension for another 2 years. But Lopez has decided not to reapply. She thinks it wouldn't help her all that much.
Since I'm married to a citizen and I have my kids, as my lawyer has told me, I have a stronger case not to get deported.
And Lopez now owns her own house cleaning business, so she can't get fired. It's an unusual position. Most people Lopez knows who have DACA are relying on it for work, including her sisters. One of them has already reapplied.
You know, my documented siblings, they depend on it. They can't continue their careers on it, and they can't feed their families without it, you know? I just can't imagine myself, like, going through something like that.
At the University of Utah, lawyers are volunteering their time to consult with undocumented students. Alonzo Reyna Rivarola is the coordinator of the Dream Center on campus. He himself has DACA status that expires in August next year. Rivarola and the lawyers here are advising students to reapply for DACA if they can.
If you have that opportunity to be protected for another 2 years while we wait for a decision to be made in Congress, then do it. You know, I would say it's an opportunity to, again, continue studying, working, saving money, or just continue living the most normal life that you can.
Rivarola has been helping people access financial aid for application fees and legal resources. He's also seen a need for mental health support.
We see students who, in this interesting world where they have to excel academically and in every single way, shape, and form in their lives in order to be validated. Those expectations are so high and the anxiety of DACA going away is so real that, yes, I've seen people, like, you know, definitely struggling with, you know, mental health.
He's seen severe anxiety and panic attacks. He says people shouldn't feel like they need to suffer alone. There's help available. As for Laura Lopez, when I asked her about her health, that turned out to be an emotional question.
When you had that protection, you weren't thinking about it so much. But then when it got taken away, I guess, is when my body started reacting even worse. So I think it would calm down after. I mean, I want to calm it down before anything worse happens. You know, if I happen to get deported, I need to be able to just cope with that without waiting on a document to define my mental health.
Lopez says she's exhausted and she's hoping Congress can find a permanent solution.
I'm hoping that in the 6 months that Congress has been given to do something, like, they think about something better than DACA, because DACA only covered a certain group of people, not everyone.
She wipes away tears before going inside to see her two young boys, who are citizens of the U.S., and her parents, who are not. For The World, Andrea Smartin, Provo, Utah.
If you know anything about American protest music from the last century, you will know the name Barbara Dane. In 1964, Bob Dylan had this to say about her: "The world needs more people like Barbara, someone who is willing to follow her conscience. She is, if the term must be used, a hero." Now, knowing Dylan, he could have been talking about how Dane worked with musicians like Memphis Slim or Louis Armstrong. But by 1964, Dane was as immersed in social and political activism and music as she'd ever been. It all became one for her. And when she started Paradon Records in 1970 with her husband, Irwin Silber, it really became one. I recently spoke with Barbara Dane, now 90 years old, and I asked her the obvious question about Paradon Records. Why did you start Paradon Records? I mean, what was the idea? You had heard these songs all your life, and now a label, a single destination for protest music?
I saw that not only in my little corner of the world, but every place I went, there was something going on that led toward a better world, let's say, to make it short, a world that wouldn't be so violent and so racist and so militaristic and all of that. We wanted a world that was filled with kindness and progress.
But the music was pretty niche for the most part. Who bought the records?
Well, you know, we didn't have any money, really. It wasn't a highly financed business or anything. Everything was self-sustaining because we put out the next ones based on the income from the last ones. But my thought was that this will get these terrific songs from all these different languages, all these different movements. But the main impulse was that people were striving for various kinds of liberation and making songs about it.
Songs like this, Hay un País en el Mundo, sung by Estrella Atrao, a Puerto Rican musician, recording with Paradon Records in the 70s. Barbara Dane produced this song.
Decida el viento los apellidos de los ladrones y las cavernas y abrí los ojos donde un desastre los campesinos no tienen tierra.
These are the kind of songs, material that goes to people who are actually engaged on the ground.
Los que la roban no tienen ángeles.
It went on for 10 years like that, growing, 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 because it was a real demand, but only within the circles that knew about it.
No tienen tierra, no tienen tierra.
But the demand was there, and in fact, that's why I finally had to give it up, because it was turning into a real business.
Oh, interesting.
I'd have to have a real business then, with an office and hired people and all that, and that was not, I was not trying to become a business person. I was, and still am, an artist, and I'm singing for particular reasons, and not about just selling something.
You know, as we saw last year with the election, there are working class voices that are left wing. There is also the working class that elected Donald Trump. Do you think you neglected those working class voices when you were recording albums with Paradon?
Well, I think that there's such a distortion of all of that, of the aims and hopes and dreams of those people that Trump, I think it's such a misinterpretation of who they are and what they are, and misleading them. And I don't think you're going to find any worthwhile songs coming out of their thing. The fascists usually don't know how to write songs anyway.
Really? I mean, you believe that there is a lack of musical kind of skill, depending on your political point of view?
Can you recall any great fascist songs? I'm just saying the songs that anybody'd want to sing. What do you want to sing about the kind of issues that they would be singing about? You wouldn't. And if they're singing about them, they're doing it within their own group, the same as we were. Everybody has their own on the ground in their community. But whether they gain any agency, any coin, you know, in the rest of the world, well, it's up to if people agree with those views. Maybe they'll pick up the songs, but I doubt it.
So, I mean, you've seen a lot. What is your advice for reaching people through protest music?
Get out in the street and sing with them and listen to them. Listen to what they want, what they're saying, what they're trying to get across. Be part of it. And don't be afraid. Say what you have to say. Don't be looking for a market or anything. Just be looking for a response from the people, the faces in front of you. Are they with you? Will they sing with you? This is music of the people. This is honest music of struggle. There's blood, sweat, and tears in this stuff for real. It's not just some kind of a poetic device.
Barbara Dane, thank you very much. I really enjoyed this interview.
Well, thank you. I hope you are not one of those who has to self-censor yourself too much.
Oh, I hope I
But I'm sure
it
goes on all the time. You can't help it. Everybody wants to keep their job and their livelihood, so...
Well, there's politeness and there's self-censorship. I try and be polite, and I try not to self-censor. So everybody's connected in a way. Yeah.
Sure. Well, it's not called a system for nothing. We live in a capitalist system. It's not just capitalism. It's a capitalist system. And so you have to sort of differentiate between what the system is making things look like and making things happen and... back up and say, okay, outside of that system, there are these other things in the world that are very important and that need to be understood. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Your interest and your, I'm sure, objectivity, hopefully.
<We try>. All right.
Okay.
All the best to you.
Best to you, too. Bye-bye.
Well, they say I was born in the land of
This is Barbara Dane's Resistance Hymn, and that is Barbara Dane on vocals, a talent behind the mic and setting up the mic. That interview is part of Future Folk, a partnership between the world and the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
But our freedom's available if our conscience is bad. I'm going to prison so I can be free. I'm going to prison for what I believe. I've got something I'll try for.
PRI, Public Radio International.